CliffCentral.com.
Ed Sheeran and Justin Bieber and I Don't Care. Do you care?
Why do they? It sounded like Why Do They when it started. I thought it was like, what? Quite a song. Heaven.
Gareth, what's the tune?
The theme tune. Do sing the theme tune. Do the theme
I don't care. Justin Bieber.
Ed Sheeran.
All right, so...
I always think of people just only listen to things without context. If you just heard those 5 seconds, you'd think
we'd lost our minds.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I got this email, and I'd like everybody to join me now. This comes from, let me just see here, Michelle. She's from Durban. She's a singer, and she was wondering if she could get a bit of professional feedback from all of us. She'd love to be a singer. She says she writes, sings, composes songs, and she's been doing that since the age of 7. Will you take some time to listen, please? There is a few songs that I've sung. So, I'm a little bit nervous about this, Michelle. I've got to be honest. You've written to me. I'm not sure I'm the right person to do this. I'm sort of not that interested in judging singers anymore. I did that for a while, and just because you asked so nicely, we're all going to do it. So, I think this is a cover of the song Shallow, which is Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper.
Oh, from the movie?
From, yeah, what's that movie called?
Stars Born.
That's right. So here she is singing, and you tell me if you like this, all right? So everybody, this is her singing over the original, and tell me if you like Michelle's voice, all right? And don't hold back, everybody, right?
Tell me something, girl. Are you happy in this modern world? Or do you need more? Is there something else you're searching for? I'm falling. In all the good times I find myself longing for change.
You heard enough? Or do you want to get to the chorus?
Yeah, can you hear the chorus?
Always want to get to the chorus.
Okay. How far is
how
the
far
chorus?
Is the chorus?
There we go. All right, let's do this. Okay. Here it is. Okay, yeah, Pumi, you go first. Go. Go on. Okay, Sia, you go first.
No, you have to
I'm
go first.
I'm not going to. I'm not in any hurry to judge this woman singing.
I don't know any better.
Well, someone
it
says...
It sounds good.
Someone says, it's so breathy, please make it stop. That is from Monga. Sorry, Monga. Morgan.
Monga.
Wow.
She can sing... But don't try and sound like Lana Del Rey. Singing your own voice is a piece of feedback here. This is from Eddie. Then Michelle can be a guest star on Sia van der Laan as the ultimate antagonist.
How?
That's vicious. That's
wait,
from Sifrid.
Based on her singing voice, we're now saying she can act as well.
Yeah, someone else saying that she should go for vocal training. So people are not holding back here. Anything else? All right, there we go.
Like
thank you.
Singing and music, you know,
that's
it's
enough.
Like magic.
You right, please
just never know.
Please
you
do
never
not
know
mean.
What's gonna,
please
it is.
Do not send me your singing and ask me to evaluate you. I'll give you Unati and Randall and Somizi's email addresses. You can get hold of them anytime you like. I'm definitely not in that game anymore.
Enter Idols.
There's
thank
a
you.
New
the
season
voice.
Coming. I saw that.
Are they doing another one?
Leave me alone.
Okay.
Would you,
like,
away.
Would you like to know how to drink like an expert on an airplane?
Drink
excuse me?
Alcohol.
Yeah, to drink like an expert on an airplane.
Wow.
Wait,
yes.
Drinking, the expert of drinking or the expert of drinking on a plane?
Listen to my point. So drinking on a plane is considered one of the few things that make modern air travel bearable. The process comes with complications and questions that would never arise on firm ground. How do I pace myself when I have nothing to do but watch movies and fight for my armrest? How much worse will my jet lag be if I have a third Bloody Mary? Do I have an aisle seat, or will I have to wake my neighbor to use the bathroom? Plus, what actually tastes great at 35,000 feet?
These are all important questions.
Yeah, they are important questions.
And the answers are?
No, well, you, this is the point, right? There's a whole lot of different answers. And if you want to go into it, most important thing that they say in here is probably don't drink at all on a plane. I know that you don't want to hear that information.
No.
That's what they say.
Why? Why not?
Well, because you're going to get a hangover if you drink too much. If you drink too little, it's going to make you want to drink more. And the idea is that you're going to have to fight for people's armrests, and you have to get up and go to the bathroom. And the best thing to do on a plane, take a sleeping tablet and go to sleep.
I can only answer part of that conversation, and
what
that's
you,
because
what
of this.
Do you drink on a plane?
This very cool app that I found a while ago. It's called Time Shifter.
Oh, yeah?
You log in the time in which you're leaving and the time in which you'll land in any destination, and also then you note what that destination is. And Time Shifter will do the calculations
helps
for
you. Figure out the sleeping pattern.
So then we'll say you should actually sleep X amount, you should stop drinking here, you should start eating then, and like it...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it makes your commute as like easy as possible. So that's only just part.
Do you drink on a plane, Pumi?
Part of that.
With my food... Not excessively.
No. Ha, have you ever gone through turbulence tipsy? That's a good time. If you have any fear or anxiety with flying in general or when it comes to turbulence, it turns, 8 hours into a prolonged roller coaster. Like, woo! Almost died there, but that's fine. Let's go again.
Unbelievable. Look at you.
Did that once. I wouldn't advocate it all the time, but I'm just saying it was great.
Well, speaking of, the jet lag, I wondered, because did you see any of the images of the president coming out of Brazil?
No.
Because they were at this BRICS summit, right, in Brazil. And I saw 3 or 4 pictures of the man sleeping.
Cyril.
Yeah. And I wondered if, is it jet lag? Is it boring? Is it, I was just like, what's going on with this guy? He should have just stayed home.
Here are things that you should know, though, about drinking, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Here are some tips. So first of all, stay adequately hydrated. So if you do like
that's
alcoholic
drinking
beverages,
anyway, though.
Yeah, but you're not getting the hydration from the alcohol. That's going to dehydrate you. So make sure that you have a little bit of water with it. Because a lot of people like soft drinks and alcoholic beverages, but plain old water is the best thing to drink on a plane, even though it's perhaps the least exciting choice. Number two, do not order water on the plane unless it's bottled. This is important. Even though there are several good reasons why staying hydrated is important, you'll never want to drink the tap water on a plane.
I didn't even know there's tap water on the plane.
Flight attendants previously told Business Insider that they won't touch it because the tanks that store the plane's water supply are rarely cleaned, which creates a breeding ground for bacteria and microbial growth. In an EPA study in 2004, it's a couple of years ago, but they found 15% of aircraft water supplies passed health regulations. 1/5. The rest did not. Things have seemingly only marginally improved in the years since. Recent studies have shown that tanks on both short and long-haul flights show signs of bacteria.
Ugh.
Look, I mean, they don't serve it from the trolley, but I think they're saying don't go to the bathroom and drink from the tap.
You shouldn't be drinking from the tap in the bathroom anyway.
In general.
Right. If you're stocked with bottled water, you'll want to avoid ice cubes in any drink since they come from the same water source.
Ordering think about that.
Ice on a plane may feel like a refreshing way to keep your drink cool as you doze off, but you could be upping your risk for illness without realizing it. Where do you think they make the ice? I mean, they might have made it in the city that it's not always bad, but it could be.
No.
And whether you're trying to perk up or unwind with a hot cup of tea, you should try and order your hot beverage in the terminal before boarding. Why? Because the ground coffee is loaded into the airplane and prepackaged and in bags of coffee. The coffee makers are made to be removable and easy to replace, but the only time they're removed is when they break, which is rare. Only The tray where the coffee bags goes and the actual coffee pot is ever removed and cleaned. For any reason, the coffee bags are thin. So if a bag bursts, the flight attendants clean the tray in the bathroom sink.
Gareth, I think you need to stop now.
No, wait, this is important.
I think you need to stop. A person may never, ever be able to be on a plane and look at things the same.
Listen.
Yo.
If you're on a long-haul flight and you decide to enjoy more than a couple of cocktails to help pass the time, bad move, says Dr. Sean Tsuda, who is a board-certified general surgeon.
Why is that bad?
He says, because of the lower level of oxygen in your blood while flying, you may seem drunker in the air than you would on the ground.
Oh.
After consuming the same amount of alcohol. The air in an aircraft is also very dry, which, coupled with the diuretic effect of drinking alcohol, may make you dehydrated faster than you would be on the ground. Your taste buds also become noticeably dulled due to high pressure in the cabin, so wine seems more acidic and watery when consumed in flight, and you may not enjoy that glass of rosé as much as you would on the ground.
So you just want more.
And while a few drinks might help you fall asleep, alcohol affects both the quality and quantity of your sleep, messing with your circadian rhythm and blocking REM sleep. So you'll
look
wake up.
There's circadian that word again. Rhythm
right.
Again.
Yes.
Oh, very fancy.
And a lot of people order a double so they won't have to wait for a refill.
Is that bad?
Well, apparently the reasons that you don't want to do that are the same as the reasons that you don't want to be intoxicated in the first place. That much alcohol in one drink will accelerate your intoxication levels due to air quality on a plane and make you feel effect much more quickly. Spacing drinks out is the safest choice on the ground and at 35,000 feet. And don't order complicated drinks. Most airlines don't have set limits for how much you can drink, but it's important to remember flight attendants are there to keep you safe and they're not there as your personal bartender. If you do want to enjoy a few drinks, keep your order as simple as possible. In fact, when people were asked about the most annoying cocktail order, one of the flight attendants said his team dreaded when a passenger ordered a Bloody Mary. He said it takes an age to sort out all the trimmings and it's infectious. As soon as one person asks for one, half the cabin want one too.
What are these? Which are these airlines that are like serving cocktails?
A proper cocktail. We're flying in the incorrect class, clearly.
We're flying in the kettle class.
I think this is in the front of the plane.
But I once read as well, just in passing, that cabin crew also don't really like it when you order a diet something or a sugar-free something, because that it just stalls them slightly, because that has more
gas in it.
More gas.
Yeah, that's right.
So which means as they pour, they have
exactly
to like
right.
stand there and
the
wait for...
The most annoying soft drink for the flight crew to open is Diet Coke, because of the high altitude, which causes carbonation to foam up more. Huh.
So they have to spend more time on you.
It takes much longer to pour and ups the risk of spillage. Sticking with flat drinks helps things move along
but
faster.
But also if you want to flirt.
Oh, right.
See, I look at you on that Mile High Club.
If you want to take advantage of the free alcohol on your flight but don't want to imbibe right then and there, be sure to take the bottles with you in your carry-on. Or if you're bringing alcohol to and from your final destination...
You're very serious.
Yeah, right. The best way is to travel without breaking any bottles if you're in transit. If you want to bring home bottles, you'll have to pack them in your suitcase. Bring some padded, resealable bottle sleeves. They pack flat, and if the bottle gets damaged, the resealable bag will absorb the liquid. I've never thought of taking a bottle off of a plane. I hope you haven't either. It's disgusting. You should be embarrassed if that's what you do. Please, dear
That's
God.
The type of
that
life you live.
That is very serious. So that is a lot of information going into the holiday season, y'all.
Ooh, tons of traveling taking place. Talking about airlines, though, here's a bit of an SAA
update.
Now,
we're having an SAA story now.
Just a brief update. And it seems that as much as we might be affected by this, I actually read a bit of a sad post from a couple who was in the country for their honeymoon over their week, over last week, and now they were stuck in Johannesburg, even though they've like planned going to Cape Town and whatnot. It's like, oh. What else can you do? But seems like we might be affected by the SAA strike, but our politicians actually will not be.
How?
So I was actually under the impressions that the free flights that they get are with the national carrier. but evidently not.
Are they with anyone?
Anyone. For free. Government all the time. Pay, yeah.
Jesus.
So even if SAA goes bust, this will not affect SA politicians at all. So if you think about the more than 400 members of the National Assembly, they are all entitled to 88 domestic flights a year. And members of the cabinet receive 30 domestic business class flights a year as well. Did you know that even if you were in the cabinet and you aren't anymore, you're still entitled to free flights a year?
Does that mean Martinus van Schalkwyk is still getting free flights?
Former cabinet ministers are entitled to 48 business class domestic flights.
Jesus.
And former deputy ministers are entitled to 36 business class domestic flights a year as well.
I don't know about you, but I'm unhappy about this.
Mm-hmm.
This is very upsetting. I don't like it at all.
So yeah, we'll have to endure SAA and to see what happens there. But no, politicians, they got some things to do.
They don't have to worry.
Yeah, they'll be fine.
Good for them. How nice. I feel very happy for them. Don't you, Pums?
Let the record show I had nothing to add.
Which means?
The politicians will always be okay. Doesn't matter what happens to the rest of us. That was a very unhappy Pumi sound.
Very much so.
All right.
Okay, here's something else to worry about. If Howard Dembowski is hopping on about this, then this is something to pay attention to.
Yeah, remember we had him. He's someone to listen to, this guy.
Yeah.
What does he say now?
He wants us to pay attention to the Protection of Personal Information Act.
Oh, yeah?
And yes, we talk about how we've been so lax recently on the show, and especially Leanne says, ugh, our information will be out there soon enough. Who really cares about it? But Howard says, folks, we need to actually be paying attention to things like this. Here's a very basic scenario. Howard wants us to even start standing up against our driver's license being used when we enter somewhere. Let this the paranoia set in.
No, but this is the thing for me. The number of estates that when you get to the gate, they,
for what?
You know, with your driver's license and your car's tag, with all that information.
They have plenty to go on. Thank you.
A person can just change the ownership of your vehicle.
So what does Howard Dembowski say? Let's listen to
that. What are we going to do, though?
Well, before Howard, this is what a lot of these security companies and these estates and these buildings are saying. Yes, Sispumi, you're right. They use these handheld scanners. They come up to your car, they scan your vehicle disc, and then they ask to see your license disc as well, and that's what they scan. Well, according to many of these companies, including the ones who make these scanning devices, they say that they don't pull more information from your license card than what is visible on the face of the card already.
Yeah.
But why do they need to keep the record?
Yeah, what in some estate, you're going to visit a friend of yours and they need this information?
Police. Things that make you go, So they say, no. All we deal with is your photograph, which is on the card, your full name, your ID number, your date of birth as well.
That's already too much.
But it's already on your card, even with that, yeah.
But what are they going to do with it?
I don't know. Effectively, they argue that they may as well be making a photocopy of the license. That's
that's what we have a problem with. The fact that you now have a photocopy of my license.
I'm afraid I agree.
Slightly educated and security guard standing at the gate of some random estate.
And he's selling the information to someone with all for all you know. But I also don't even want, frankly, I don't want the people who run the estate even having that information, right?
Oof.
Dude.
I mean, listen.
So Howard Dembowski, working with the Justice Project, is absolutely disagreeing to this, and he wants each of us to pay attention. So he says that the devices pull far more information than some manufacturers claim, and that he has concerns about both how the data is stored and how it's accessed, that in the wrong hands, it can actually do a lot of damage. So although he hasn't named and shamed any companies in particular and very specifically, he says that they can easily demonstrate how these, he can actually demonstrate how these handheld barcode scanning devices, if they're linked to the likes of eNatus, can pull your photograph, your residential and work addresses, various telephone numbers that are registered in your name.
But what are we going to do? Because yesterday, I had to go for a meeting somewhere. So this is a company that I'm doing business with.
Mm.
And they scan my ID and then my car registration.
I have left my car in the street.
You will?
I have.
Okay.
So it sounds very dramatic.
So if you won't, so I have two things. First, I have an expired license.
Yeah.
That if you need to scan, you can scan that.
Oh, that's smart. No, but it's still linked to you.
It is still linked to you. Yeah, but if I'm uncomfortable with the place, the people, I will rather leave my car on the side of the road outside there and walk in. Because when you walk in on foot.
Yeah.
Well.
What's here?
I'm thinking.
Say what's on your mind.
Is that really like an alternative? Like, how long do we do that for? Howard actually also lists that as something that he does as well. He says that there are instances where he's left his car outside of certain, you know, building complexes or housing estates, and he rather walks on foot.
Listen, Howard Dembowski, if you spend more than 5 minutes with the guy, he's going to have you so paranoid.
Right?
Jesus.
Oh, no.
We've had him here in the studio. Afterwards, you're terrified of everything. I mean, he's one of those people who, thank God, is busy paying attention to this stuff. Most of us don't think.
Well, everything is terrifying. There's in Linden, my office is in Linden. Mm. In Linden, literally every other street corner has these, all of a sudden, these like tracker cameras that have just like, and I'm just like, what are they doing with all of this footage? Mm. What are they doing with all of this footage? Who are they? And why do they need it? Yeah. And why is my, you know, like, I'm still like, this is still a public road.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a public road.
Mm-hmm.
Yikes. So the reason why Howard is bringing this to our attention and particularly putting the spotlight on the Protection of Personal Information Act is so that there's some form of regulation around all of this. Because he says with a lot of these companies that are registered with, you know, these handheld scanners, no one actually monitors what they're doing with the information. So even with that, these companies they allow multiple logins into their back-end systems, which means multiple people have access to all of our details. No one audits that. Once you're inside the back-end system, you're allowed to email reports. You're allowed to print these reports with clients' details. You're allowed to store information for longer than 3 months. So who is getting access to all of this?
So I want to be someone rich like Wendy Applebaum, right? So it can just sue random estates.
Mm.
Be like, yeah, I was at this estate and then my information was just sue the estate.
Because then they'll
bankrupt
stop.
The entire estate.
Yeah, then they'll stop. So Nick Quinn says, what's the reason that they don't just use your registration of your car anymore? Surely that's enough info for security companies. I don't know why they need all this stuff anyway. You know, it's not like they've managed to track down robbers by finding... These guys are probably using fake IDs and stolen cars anyway. So what the hell difference does that make? The only people who get penalized here are law-abiding citizens, right? Jesus, enough already. A Virgin Active refused me entry to the restaurant inside the gym once because I refused to give them my ID.
Wow.
And I'm not a member. Guys, my uncle was an MP premier to the Western Cape, one of the last ones, and up to his death a few months ago, he and his wife still traveled business class with SAA for free internationally. I think the limit was 10 flights a year. See, this is what we're paying for in this country.
Wow.
Politicians. Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah, so just concluding the story, it seems so horrible to think about, but as you pointed out, Sispumi, like once people even have access to the likes of your VIN number, your vehicle identification number, someone can easily transfer the vehicle out of that person's name in a heartbeat.
That's scary. That is very scary.
So what are the options that we have apart from
take an Uber?
Apart from leaving your car outside a complex and walking in? Sounds very dramatic, but Howard says...
But you can't even walk into some of these places. You still have to give them your ID.
Here we go. Howard suggests that we each take our own written contracts with us.
Gee, you're kidding me.
He says, have your own written contract.
Do not invite Howard Dembowski to your house.
Just for dinner on a Wednesday night, he pitches up with a contract.
By the way, we're not just talking about very expensive, exclusive estates that people live in. We're talking about just... like blocks of flats now. that have these entry mechanisms.
But and then
going
I'm
for
still,
meeting.
Yeah.
I'm still astounded at the number of people that wake up in the morning and put on their like Twitter feed that my car was stolen in my complex. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Even with all though, of that, yeah.
With all of that, and you live in the complex, and then you wake up in the morning and your car's gone.
Yeah.
It's very scary.
So this is what he says this contract should specify. Make notes, people.
You're ready for Howard, everybody.
Because I'm about to add this as well.
Yeah.
He says that your written contract should assure you that your data is safe and will be destroyed within a specific time frame. Howard believes that no company should keep this information for longer than 24 hours, and this time frame should be stipulated in the document.
So, sure.
Yeah.
Except, like, and Gareth can bear us out on this, like, all laws, all contracts need to be enforceable. And in order to be able to enforce it, you must know that after 48 hours, they still had your data.
Right.
And the person who signs the contract must be a person who's authorized to sign such contracts. So,
correct.
Like when you get to the gate and there's like Sipo standing there and you're like, sign this contract.
Sipo's not in a position.
Yeah, Sipo's like, not authorized.
Wait, what is
so
going
that contract
on here?
Is void. It's not a, it's not binding.
Can we turn our attention overseas quickly? Because as much as I find all of this horrifying, Howard Dembowski is the only guy who's going to carry around a contract. So everybody else calm the hell down. What's this, what's happening with Colin Kaepernick? I don't know the story, but you Pumi said she knows what's going on there. So come on, regale us.
Let me just stretching.
Oh, okay. Alrighty.
All right, bring it on.
What
do we got?
So Colin, this past weekend, had scheduled a training session. And the training sessions is where the scouts for the various NFL
because
teams...
Because he hasn't had a job since he took a knee.
He hasn't had a job for 3 years.
Right.
And earlier this year, he sued the NFL and he won. It's an undisclosed amount between $1 million and $10 million US dollars that the settlement was for the fact that they have closed him out. So colluding with each other, all the teams in the NFL colluding with each other to keep him out, to not give him employment.
Right.
So they finally folded. And what they then said they were going to do is the NFL, as a group, were all going to have their scouts at a training session at an undisclosed venue is what they wanted. And Colin had to come and train out there and the scouts would all be there to see if they would any of them would pick him. For the. And Colin and his team obviously said no. First of all, it can't be a closed session. They wanted it available. So they wanted news outlets there. They wanted to be able to film and share the footage. Well, it makes sense, right? Because he wants to be able to say, to hold them accountable. So if they come out of a closed session and say, actually, he's not fit enough, that's why we didn't pick him. He wants to be able to share the footage that says, oh, well, look at this.
Yeah.
And the footage that they put out there was actually Colin throwing some seriously deep passes, looking fit, looking on form. Amazing.
All right.
The second part of the contract that they wanted him to sign was around injury. So standard contracts in the NFL, if you get injured at a training session, then the NFL has to take care of that because it's your instrument, right? If you get injured, you tore a hamstring, you can't train, you lose an opportunity for income. But they wanted him to sign one that says he's not going to sue them if anything happened, and they wouldn't be liable if he got injured. So his team again said no.
Okay.
Then the NFL was like, well, if you're not signing this, we're not showing up to your training session. And this is the debacle now, and everybody's climbed in, including Jay-Z, to say, and everybody's divided on the Colin Kaepernick issue, right? There are people who are saying, well, Colin is standing up for his rights. Colin is, you know, freedom of speech, all of that.
Sure.
And people are saying, well, he's a sportsman. He shouldn't get political. And now the big division is, did Colin make this a spectacle? Was this just like Colin not agreeing to sign these contracts?
He sounds like, as talented as the guy is, he sounds like a hell of a lot of work for a manager of a team. Like, sometimes you get a really talented employee, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you've been in advertising, Pumi, and you know from your experience also in training in HR, you know how rare it is to find someone who's got an exceptional talent. Now, let's assume Colin is that person. Sometimes, though, when there are a huge amount of admin, when they're just too much work, you're sometimes willing to forego the talent. You're like, and sometimes you're willing to forego the work for the talent,
yeah.
Right? So it depends on your priorities. And maybe if you're a football manager, you go, well, there are other athletes that won't give me as much fucking admin as this guy, so maybe I won't take him. Or maybe he's worth the admin.
So I'm just reminded, every time I read about Colin and what he's standing up for, I'm reminded out of a certain, you know, young professional called Cassius Clay,
mm-hmm.
who also
was hard work.
And stood up for what he believed in.
He did.
And I think today, when we look back at an undisputed greatest
of
all
time. That's Muhammad Ali's real name.
You didn't know about Cassius Clay?
I sat on the Googler thinking, my. See, I know you don't know sports, but I've never heard of a great sure. Cassius Clay.
Wow.
I had to go to... Sorry, yes.
And today we sit here and he's on the right side of history.
Yeah. That's fair enough. But you got to ask yourself, is it worth it? You're some rich dude who's trying to own a football team. And maybe this is what you're doing with your retirement. And maybe this is investment because you're passionate about the game. And maybe you don't want to be involved in activism. And maybe this guy brings you great publicity because you're the team that has him on and you know he's going to get attention. But maybe it's just too much work.
Being blackballed is a real thing. There's some people who just go, and I'm sure this is the case even with Colin, who look at it and they go, oh, well, do we want this attention?
Really? Don't be so much trouble.
Yeah, it's like,
don't be that native.
Is it worth it? No, he's great and all of that, but let's not touch him now.
Don't be that native.
I know it for certain. Even Vatsi Sondara recently, when she was speaking out about, you know, South African acting industry and being paid X amount, she was adamant with saying, I know I'm probably not going to be cast anytime soon. I think it would be fantastic if we could change up how this tale ends, and you know, she gets jobs just based on her talent. But I know a lot of people will look at her and go,
too much work.
Yeah, do we want to? Maybe not.
And I think it's okay.
I think it's sad.
I think it's okay to have people who feel that strongly about issues that they're willing to put themselves on that front line. It's important.
Yeah,
it's how we move forward.
And it's not easy,
as
though.
A society.
That's why a lot of people don't stand up.
Not supposed to be easy.
On another matter, here is At, who says, guys, the Ed Snowden book is amazing. You will never look at technology and data collection again. I've now covered all my webcam devices. That's from Adam. Sorry, it's Adam, not At. So Adam's covering up every... Like, I have a camera on my laptop. I've never covered it. I know Dory in the office does. I know a lot of other people who do.
What are you up to, people? What is it that you are doing?
I think there's some happy medium here. Ultimately, I've said it before, all of us are going to end up with stuff online that we might not want. But if all of us are, then it's okay. So you can't be paranoid. You can't live like in prison. I live in Blair Gowrie. That's obviously that's in Randburg, which is an industrial area. This is from Babaz. It says, I live in Blair Gowrie. They wanted to put a street camera in front of our yard and requested to connect the cameras to our power line. We refused.
No.
It was just freaky that we will be monitored as we drive in and out by people we don't know. Good for you.
Refusing. Well done.
Yeah. Well done, Babaz. Then we've got this one comes in from someone arguing with you. This is Ron, who says, Kaepernick is not Muhammad Ali. Get real, Pumi. All right, that's all we got time for now, because it's time for Blind History. It's episode 10, actually, and it's Attila the Hun. You know about Attila the Hun?
And the Huns.
The Huns. It's absolutely incredible. This guy, I mean, there's so much about his story that is... just blew my mind when I did the research. But here it is, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. And remember, they've got a special deal on where, if you are very, very clever, you can get on to getting some blinds at a discounted rate. But you've got to go to cliffcentral.com to find out more. So go and take a look, and you can listen to this on podcast, or if you feel like listening to it live now, you're in luck, because it's time for Blind History Season 2, Episode 10. We're coming to the end of Season 2. It's just around the corner. Here's Attila the Hun. From the great steppes of Central Asia to the dark forests of Northern Germany, from dusty Syria to the walls of Rome itself, there once existed a vast empire, the Kingdom of the Huns. During the darkest of ages, the fearsome Huns dominated the nightmares of all of Europe, and then, almost like a bad dream, they were gone. The body of Attila the Hun lies with the men who buried him, killed so nobody could ever find his final resting place. Undisturbed for all of history, Attila continues to sleep soundly, and nobody knows where. He was a man born into the world to shake the nations, the scourge of all lands, who in some way terrified all of mankind by the dreadful rumors noised abroad concerning him. He was haughty in his walk, rolling his eyes hither and thither, so that the power of his proud spirit appeared in the movement of his body. He was indeed a lover of war, yet restrained in action, mighty in counsel, gracious to supplicants, and lenient to those who were once received into his protection. Short of stature, with a broad chest and a large head, his eyes were small, his beard thin and sprinkled with grey, and he had a flat nose and swarthy skin, showing evidence of his origin. Attila the Hun.
Ah, I really loved this guy.
Did you?
I really enjoyed
Attila. What's to love? He was a maniac.
He was a maniac. He was a barbarian. Absolute.
They say that when he was a kid, he was already a maniac.
Yeah, I didn't read that, but you know that anybody that wasn't Roman at that time was a barbarian.
Yeah, sure.
And these just so happened to be the scariest barbarians. The barbarians feared these barbarians.
Well, the weird thing is we can't even really tell where he might have come from. You know, he might have been from Mongolia. Mm. He might have been from the Ukraine. There's an area in the Ural Mountains where a lot of those languages seem to originate from. Or he could be from modern Hungary, which is named after him.
Well, they also say Kazakhstan, which is to what you were saying, possibly. Mm. But there is a story that the Visigoths, they mentioned, was that they had a certain people within the Goths or the Visigoths that were witches. And the king decided to get rid of these witches because it was creating the wrong dynamics and it was scary and they were putting voodoos on everybody.
We didn't really need witches.
Yeah, exactly. So he got rid of the witches, but the witches didn't disappear. They went into swamps around the Hungarian area and they spawned the Huns. And that's where the Huns came from. In the beginning, they couldn't talk. They were almost like aliens. And slowly but surely, they've developed into a human-type race.
Oh, my God.
And they became the Huns.
That sounds horrible.
Everybody feared them. And what was so scary is that they were very skillful on horses, where a lot of the barbarians weren't. Mm. And so that created even more fear. But it was true. They eat, they slept, they had sex, they negotiated, bought, sold, did everything on their horses.
I mean, he would negotiate all his deals, and while he was standing there, the other people would be cowering kind of underneath his horse. But he must have been a fearsome guy. He was apparently short.
He was stout, and he used to just charge around and slap things out the way, and it was what we would maybe see in these old movies. He only ate off wooden boards, and whereas if he had to have guests, they would have the porcelain or whatever it is, and he just ripped a leg off a moving donkey or something and ate it. So he was quite scary.
Well, he came from this Hunnic tribe, and we've discussed a little bit about what their origins might have been. But his father died when he was quite young, and then his uncle adopted him. And he had, it was either a brother or a half-brother called Bleda, who was really meant to inherit the kingdom. But these Huns would challenge each other to a duel, effectively. And for the first while he was in his uncle's custody, he was mostly just paying attention, trying to learn. He would lead some of the incursions into the various villages, and they would pillage, and they would take the women and children captive and make the men slaves. And, you know, they kind of did what barbarians did.
Correct.
Which was to just...
Everybody did that, actually.
They would raise the place. They would just burn it all down, and then that was their territory now. And there was obviously quite a lot of mythology around him. So much of what we know today is wrapped up in legend, and we're not sure how much is true and how much isn't. There aren't any existing portraits of him from that time. But what happened, unfortunately, is that everybody who described him after that described him as this grotesque, terrifying, subhuman monster.
Well, it comes from the Romans, obviously, because nobody else actually took note of anything properly for historians. Mm. They portrayed him as a monster. But interestingly, Rugula, which was his uncle, was incredible. He actually started already hammering away at the Romans, and he built an empire already before Bleda and Attila took over. So there was definitely a semblance of an empire already started from Rugula before Attila, but Attila just took it to the next level.
Yeah, Attila did fall in love with a red-headed slave girl who he eventually took as his wife. But Bleda, just to spite him, after they'd captured all the slaves from that girl's village, Bleda could see that Attila quite liked the look of her, and he claimed her as his bounty. And this started a bit of a rivalry between the two, which was only settled when eventually Attila killed Bleda and took over. But that happened post something interesting, because he was involved with the Romans. There was communication between the Huns and the Romans. And he went to Rome on the invitation of Attius, who was a Roman general. And he saw Rome, the good sides of Rome. He spent time in the royal court. He ate at banquets. He was captivated by the idea of a bath, a hot bath. And, you know, the Romans had these enormous baths where they would heat the water in cisterns and furnaces. And then it would be, you know, this luxury of kind of getting into this warm water inside marble stairs and all that kind of thing. And he wanted one built in the territories that he occupied. And they took a long time to eventually build one of these things.
I can imagine.
It's all he wanted. Yeah. He wanted that more than anything else. And he had people killed if they didn't deliver the bath on time.
But that period shows his loyalty, because Aetius, he only right at the very end of his life did he decide to go to the Western Empire, because the empire split between West and East. Mm-hmm. Constantinople was actually the more rich and the stronger of the two at this period in history. And he stayed away because Aetius had spent time in Rugula's court, in his dad's court. They took him capture, but he learned a lot. They became good friends. So he really didn't want to really mess around with Aetius, which in fact,
and the Western Roman Empire.
And the Western Roman Empire.
But he didn't have a lot of respect for the Eastern Roman Empire.
No, he just, Theodosius.
He saw it as a till.
Yeah, exactly. He smashed them. Every year he would go and change the agreements. And Theodosius was just shitting himself. I mean,
Theodosius was the emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire.
Yes, he built up Constantinople.
Yeah.
Because he knew that the Attila kept smashing away. And he had nothing left on the Danube. But the problem was also he had wars from African side. So Theodosius was struggling.
There was something interesting about Attila that was recorded by the Romans, and they thought quite highly of him because of this. He would never settle a dispute between two warring tribes or kingdoms that he'd conquered without both being present. And if you tried to kind of win him over to your side while the other person wasn't there, he would take very drastic action. He didn't like the idea of people taking advantage and not being fair.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to say, because he wasn't just a marauding barbarian.
No.
He could never have built an empire the size that he did. You know, he had to have some intelligence. But what happened was that when Theodosius died, Martian came as the emperor.
Yeah.
And Martian had a bit more balls than Theodosius did. And so he said, I'm not paying you this money. Attila was most upset and went in again. And it was harder for Attila. He thought, no, this guy's quite strong. So maybe what I should try and do is attack the Gauls. So that was his strategy. And then it just so happened that, this is quite an important point in history, was Valentinian III's sister, Honoria.
Yeah.
She had to marry a senator or a general, I believe. And she didn't want to. She hated this man. So she sent her ring to Attila. She'd never met him before. And she said, please help me.
Now, can you imagine? This, first of all, provides Attila with a pretext for invasion. And it also gives him legitimacy.
Yeah, half the empire.
Yeah, the emperor's sister is saying, please help me, Attila. There must have been Romans who would have thought, well, that sounds legit to me. And it gave him a reason to invade.
Correct.
And he started warring with the Visigoths at that point.
Yes.
And there was some duplicity on the Roman Empire's side, because they had turned against the Visigoths with the Huns before. Now they were with the Visigoths against the Huns. So it didn't make a whole lot of sense.
But I think Aetius was just a political player. He knew Attila, and Attila knew Aetius. The problem, though, which came out, and you don't say this with Attila, was he was hesitant. He was overcautious in this battle. And this battle that happened now, that we're talking about the Catalonian plains, was one of the greatest battles of all time. The rivers were running red with blood. And there were so many people killed during that time. Theodoric, who was the Visigoths' king, was also very organized, and at the top of the Catalonian hill, they got the upper ground. And basically the Huns, when you get to a certain point with the Huns and they realize they're beaten, they scattered.
Yeah, they had to go into retreat. In fact, it was probably one of the only battles that Attila lost.
Correct. It was the only battle he lost, but he still kept his guys intact. So he managed then the next year to be able to come back.
Well, he did sack a lot of cities. He did torch the land. He did, you know, capture all the people and massacre many more. But he was open to negotiation, and it was Pope Leo III who actually eventually met him just outside of Rome and said, listen, we'd really appreciate it if you didn't sack Rome. And he agreed.
He did.
Which shows, again, the restraint that you're talking about.
Once again, with Attila, there's so many different stories. So there's that story that you've mentioned. Then there's a story that actually Pope Leo came, and then on each shoulder was St. Paul and St. Peter. And they were showing a sword to Attila. He thought, no, I'm out of here. That was obviously religiously driven. And then finally, which is probably the case, was that the Po Valley was renowned for carrying sicknesses. And also at that time, there was a massive drought. So there was no food for the Romans, let alone for the Huns. Plus, they were laden with booty because they had smashed so many cities and burnt them and stolen so much.
So it was a practical decision.
They got to Rome. He said, no, you know, I need a little bit more strength to get through this town. So they turned around and went
So
back.
Maybe not honor, but kind of pragmatic thought.
Yeah, and it just depended on who wrote the story, Gareth. I mean...
Yeah, well, this is the problem with Attila, is a lot of it is so cloudy. Like, we're not sure exactly how he died. Some people say he had a nosebleed. And that he died because he had this really bad nosebleed after a night of heavy drinking and eating. Yeah. And it was after his wedding, by the way. And other people have told the story of how his most recent bride, the woman he'd married that very day, was actually sent by the Romans, and she poisoned him. And eventually that his general found her weeping on the side of the bed, him dead in a pool of blood, and assumed that she had killed him with poison and strangled her to death as well. But the interesting thing about his death also is that we don't know where he's buried.
And the people that buried him were killed.
Yeah.
Or so they took their own lives.
I mean, somewhere in Eastern Europe could be the grave of Attila the Hun. Yeah. And we would know it was Attila because he would have been buried with all of his stuff. And, you know, they would have made a fuss of him. But nobody knows to this day where in Europe he might be buried.
And it just went downhill from there for the Huns because they were never the force again. The Suns took over, but they didn't last very long.
Bickered and fought and argued.
And then they tried to come together against the Goths, and then they were just completely flattened. What Attila and Rugula had built, incredible, and the history that they'd built over the years, it was just destroyed in one generation.
He was the king of an empire eventually, Attila, that stretched from near southern Denmark all the way to Scythia, which is like modern-day Turkey, you know, and further into the steppes of Asia even. So this was an enormous empire for him to maintain, and he maintained it fiercely. He was very, very good at that.
There's no doubt he loved power. He loved gold.
Oh, yeah.
And he absolutely loved war. He loved a good fight. So he just had all the facets to make a true barbarian.
Well, okay, I like him too. Fine. We've come to a compromise. Finally, we agree on something in an episode. So just before we finish the story of Attila the Hun, why did they call the Germans Huns in the First World War?
Well, Kaiser Wilhelm, he believed that the Huns were actually Germanic, from the Germanic region. So he likened his troops about to go to war in the First World War to Attila and the Huns.
So he was wrong, though, because they didn't come from Germany.
Exactly.
And then, of course, the Allies seized that.
100%. They said, whoa, you bunch of barbarians and marauding. It suits you perfectly. So from now on, they said, here come the Huns. Let's get the Huns. And then only in the Second World War did they change it to a softer term, they believed, which was Kraut.
Oh, so that's when they started calling them the Krauts.
The Krauts. So that's the word Huns. That's where it comes from.
All right, very good. Thanks for listening to the award-winning Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters.
cliffcentral.com.